row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers. We discuss gardening issues seasonally and describe the events and educational services we provide. The seasoning segments appear on a timely basis, according to what's happening in our gardens during the year. Outstanding in their field segments are an opportunity to introduce our most outstanding volunteers individually. Cross-pollinating stories will discuss the activities of master gardeners in additional roles. We have master foresters and master naturalists included in our membership, as well as master beekeepers. We even have brewmasters. There are other offerings available from Cooperative Extension, and we will periodically be chatting with representatives of the busy 4-H program and the Taste of New York market, as well as the various offerings for assistance with family life, from childcare to budget planning. From time to time, we will go live for a call-in show when a particularly urgent topic arises. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening.
So welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners. This is Teresa Golden, and joining me is Jean Thomas, another Master Gardener from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene County. And our guest today is Donna Peterson. So Donna, I'm going to let you introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Donna Peterson. I'm the Master Gardener Volunteer Coordinator, as well as a hort educator with Columbia and Greene of CCE. What I deal with is the Master Gardeners and coordinate the program areas that they deal with on a regular basis. So we're talking about school programs, we're talking about workshops that they do, major events like Spring Gardening Day, dealing with farmers markets, questions to our telephones that are accessible to the public, our community, individuals with problems that they have from their horticulture and their garden, their landscape, any issues of that nature. Everything from invasives all the way up to dealing with the harvest from their gardens.
So that's what master gardeners do, and they volunteer for Cooperative Extension. So a lot of people have heard of Cooperative Extension. They talk about Cooperative Extension. What's Cooperative Extension?
Cooperative Extension is actually associated with the land grant university in each state, and it is the actual extension, and the mission of the cooperative extension is to enable people to improve their lives and communities through partnerships and putting the research that the master gardeners have been trained with to use and work in their own lives.
So the Master Gardeners are a part of Cooperative Extension, and Cooperative Extension is the means of bringing all the scientific information accumulated by the land-grant colleges out to the people.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So what are Master Gardeners? Where did they start up? Where did they come from?
Well, Master Gardeners are volunteers in our local communities. Basically, they're individuals who really already have that preceded notion to help out communities, but want to know better what to tell someone. They may have some sort of horticultural background, and by that I mean simply working in their own gardens or having a good rapport with children. Or they're a retiree who decided that this would be the best way to give back to the community at large. So we have individuals who are volunteers from all walks of life. We have lawyers and doctors and architects, artists, authors, you know, there's so many individuals that make up such a great core of individuals that work together to help pass out this scientifically backed out information to the people who don't have this access at their ready.
So how long have the Master Gardeners been available as a tool to the Cooperative Extension?
Well, back in 1972, it was actually the first trial clinic was held over in Tacoma, Washington. And it was done because there was so many questions being asked and they were being overwhelmed over at Washington State University Cooperative Extension that Dr. Gibby of that same Cooperative Extension decided that he was going to formulate a Master Gardener program. And this became a U.S.-affiliated land-grant university program. So each state has different counties or townships that they have formulated, and each one has a cooperative extension. In those cooperative extensions, we have a Master Gardener program segmented just to help with the agriculture and horticulture for the communities that it is dealing with.
So it's more for home horticulture than farm?
Absolutely. The agriculture, now each cooperative extension for the most part does have lots of programs that it's involved with. We're fortunate to have an agriculture and horticulture program. So we, the Master Gardeners, specifically deal with the horticulture or landscaping issues for the normal homeowner.
So I understand there's 46 states now have Master Gardening programs, which is actually pretty impressive when you think about how many people there are out there that really are available to answer questions. How many Master Gardeners are there in Columbia and Greene County?
Well, we have 60 Master Gardener volunteers on our records, but I would say 35 to 40 are really active individuals, and they do many, many tasks to help bring out this information to our communities.
And if one wanted to become a Master Gardener, what's the process? What kind of training is involved? Where does the information come from?
Okay. Well, the information is always backed up from scientifically proven information from that land grant college, which happens to be Cornell in New York State's case. So what we do is a core training for the Master Gardeners, and this can take anywhere approximately 3 months. It could be an in-house training that would be done once a week for a full day, and will take in the core training everything from learning and bringing back basic botany from when we all sat there in grade school and high school to learn, and coming all the way up to the latest and greatest invasive species that happens to be knocking upon not only the farm stands and the farmers, but on the homeowners' doors as well.
So the biggest difference between, say, the gardening information you find on a site like Pinterest or just on the web, and what you get through the Cooperative Extension is the fact that it's research-based.
Absolutely. That research-based information has been scientifically tested. And we also have the opportunity through many avenues, if we are stymied, and a lot of times we go to, let's say, an event and we have an information booth, come bring your soil samples so we can test them, and then there's a question asked. We have that ability to go back to Cornell and talk to that individual who runs that specific program or has that expertise. And we then can ask them, well, what do they think? And sometimes it's a unique cause. So, or there's a unique problem. And if there's a unique problem, they will be able to help us with it. But again, it's all scientifically backed up. So it is not go to Bob's Best and see what you can do. This is information that is really basically tested and tried and true.
So for the average listener who may not see a Master Gardener at one of these events that we do throughout the two counties, where do they get information? Is there a website or?
Oh, absolutely. You can go to our website at Columbia and Greene Counties, and I will give you that. It is the Master Gardener volunteers actually have a Facebook post as well, so a Facebook group, I should say. So you can go there and post questions, or you can call up our office. So Our offices are in both Acre and Hudson, so you can call there. Our actual website is ccecolumbiagreen.org. And there you will open up to see many avenues. And we are underneath the gardening area. Yep. So that's where we are. So you can also go on to Columbia and Green, and we have the Master Gardeners of CCE, Columbia and Green County. That's our Facebook group. So you can get to us that way as well. And that group will also answer questions on a regular basis.
And I believe you've also got an email, which I believe is colgremg@cornell.edu.
That's correct.
colgremg@cornell.edu.
That's right. Absolutely.
And it's my understanding that you also have volunteers that actually staff the phones as well as the email.
Absolutely. We try to staff the phones, especially during the busy season, on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays at the Hudson office. But I want you to know that at any given time, we have master gardeners in both places that can answer the phone or take a message. And then in the Acre office, it is Tuesdays and Thursdays, and both of the times are usually from about 9 o'clock to about 12. So those offices are always busy, and this is the time of the year for that.
And bear in mind, as a master gardener, combat trained, they're not always in the office at that time. So please be patient. We will get to you and call you back, but we can't promise that we're going to be there at those times.
Absolutely. For those who do take advantage of the program that is available, they understand that, and they know every one of the Master Gardeners are just that. They're volunteers. They are not paid staff. I'm a paid staff employee there. So that's the difference. And yes, they take pride in the fact of returning calls. And I call them mine because I'm a little possessive of them. They are a great group of individuals who really, really take pride in what they do. So yes, by all means, if they are not in the office for whatever reason, if you leave a message, they'll get back to you in a few days. Okay. Now remember, the two counties, the combined square mileage is 1,276 miles. And the population is 109,825 people. So now while we don't get nearly that, you can only imagine that my volunteers come from the far reaches of Greene County to the far reaches, the southern part of Columbia County. So they are here to answer your questions, and they would be happy to do so.
And speaking to that, this is just an oddity that I like. How far was it from your house to Holcott Center?
About an hour and 20 minutes away. I was absolutely shocked. It was probably a little bit longer than that. It's a little recess in Greene County that kind of jettisons into Ulster County, and the only way to get there is through Ulster County. So from Austerlitz all the way up on the other side of the county in Columbia, I had to go through Greene and all the way through part of Ulster and up and over the mountain. Absolutely beautiful country, and I highly recommend that you go there and take the trip that I did, because it was fantastic.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about the two counties, is the amount of square mileage it covers, but also the hardiness zones that are covered.
Absolutely.
So the issues that perhaps you see in Hudson or Catskill, which is more like a zone 6, are a lot different than the issues you see up in Windham, which is more like a zone 4.
Absolutely. And then each place there is microclimated. But all of this information is what the master gardeners are trained to learn. And it's a continuing education process. After we have monthly meetings, and after each meeting, we have an educational feature that continues that education that they've started off with as a basis. So it works out to be really good. Lots of the master gardeners have told me that they love the idea of they learn something themselves when they come in. Some of it is you know, off the top of their heads that, you know, they've been asked questions and they know because they've been asked these questions repeatedly, time after time. And yet other ones, when they have to do the research, absolutely love that research, you know, backed part of it. So they look and they delve into the many articles that we have and on the computer. Here again, going back to land-grant associated colleges, because we do know that those places have been scientifically proved information.
Which obviously gets updated all the time.
Absolutely. It is. Everything changes. You know, say, for instance, we've our latest and greatest invasive species that comes in. So then they start doing research to find out what it is that they can do to kind of mitigate that problem and try to keep it in a base.
I understand that the Master Gardeners of Columbia and Greene County were at the forefront of identifying an invasive species called the jumping worm.
Yes, they were.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, it seems that this is an Asian jumping worm that was brought in to the United States through many of our things from Asia, through our horticulture. It was brought in some plant materials, and some individual thought it would be absolutely great as a fishing tool. Well, this worm is really moving and jumping around. So it went from, I think it was in the ports down in the southern part of the country, up to Wisconsin. And at that point in time, they realized, well, the fish didn't like them too much. And usually what happens is, well, we have three or four worms left in the container. What do we use to, what do we do with these? We're not going to keep them. So the dubious individual just kind of dumped them into the woods as they were going. Well, these individuals are not like our European earthworms. They are a much more aggressive top feeder. And they're also a worm that reproduces not once, but twice a year. So imagine the amount of carnage they could do upon your landscape when they're feeding, top feeding here. So what we found that we started getting telephone calls into the office. We used to do a plant swap at one point where people were able to go and dig up their own plant materials because you have iris beds, weigh so many of them. Let's divide them and get rid of them and get something else at our plant swap. Very well attended in both counties. Well, wound up to be that we were also passing off this invasive critter into someone's garden that may not have had them. So when we realized that this is what was being done and that we were also possibly doing this, not saying that we definitely did, we stopped that process and instead it became an education feature. We put in that it became a plant sale, and what we did was use starts and we used cuttings and did in sterile soil mixes, so we knew positively that they were not those invasive worms were not in the mix. And then we educated the individuals. And this year, at this time, we seem to be getting an awful lot of questions about it. We've had people come from the city, take a look at their garden beds and say, wow, this is a thing that I saw, or a handout that we had given out at one of our programs, and was amazed. So yes, this is one of the things that we started with, making sure that people were, that they knew that even if you go to your next door neighbor and dig up that favorite iris or that favorite peony, that you may be passing on this. And it is New York state law that prohibits you from passing on an invasive species.
What are other types of questions that your master gardeners have to deal with?
We deal with everything from pHs to why my fruit trees are not blooming, or what is the problem with my tomato plants, to insects that are inside the house, from you know, your household pets like meal moths, to unfortunately the dreaded bed bug, and you know, things of that nature. We also get pond questions. Or if we get a question that is not within our realm, we have a wealth of contact information and regional individuals who can help out, so we can pass that name on to an individual who will be able to help them.
So I have another question. I want to circle back to the continuing ed.
Yes.
This summer there was an International Master Gardeners Conference, and I think 8 Master Gardeners attended it.
Yes.
And you were there.
Yes,
I was. Tell us a little about it.
Well, that was an absolutely great source of additional information. Every day we met at one of the hotels, at which they had a great program, usually 2 to 3 keynote speakers, all of whom were excellent. One from Dr. Gibby, who actually was very proud about the fact that we were there. We got to meet almost 1,200 other master gardeners from all over the country, even some from Hawaii. So that was great. Each master gardener took different classes and the opportunity for different visits to different, you know, outreaches and gardens to get further education to see what they were all about. And all of that information that they attend and they went to and they absorb is now what we take back to give to our communities at large. So the information, if someone went to a specific garden or a background, they learned it. Or if they stayed simply at house and took one of the how to do a proper soil test or how to do involved individuals at a farmer's market, all of those helped those master gardeners. I don't think there was a person who regretted going. I think everyone really enjoyed it. Also made for a great positive camaraderie between the master gardeners because everyone was so filled with telling each and every one of us what they had gone and done.
Well, now that you've got everybody all psyched and they all want to become master gardeners, there's not a training coming up in the immediate future, but we will be having training. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I'm looking to do training sometime in the year next year. Now, we're also looking to add in core training that is done online. So I think it will expand what we normally would have had because previously it was where you had to come into the office and spend a full day. But now it will be online. You'll be able to do some of the major training and then just come in one day a month for those periods of time to review what you've learned online, do a simple test to just see what it is that you've retained, and then some organizational and information just for us. So I will be having that put out on our website. So if you are interested in joining this Master Gardener group, which is, like I said, a very great, eclectic, and well-formed group. They would love to have you join, so please feel free to go onto our website, and I am on the gardening page. You can contact me either by phone or by email there.
So the website is ccecolumbiagreen.org. There's also a Facebook. It's CC, Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Green. So feel free to follow either of those in order to stay up to date on local programming from the Master Gardeners as well as the rest of the extension.
Absolutely.
So with that, I'd like to thank Donna for joining us. You've been a delightful guest and look forward to hearing from more Master Gardeners over the course of this program. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this is Digging In with the Master Gardeners. Thank you.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Green Counties. My name is Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. We're two of the Master Gardener volunteers who help to educate county residents on a variety of community horticultural topics. Thank you for joining us today. The topic for this segment is gardening myths. Joining us for this discussion is Joanne Schlenk, a former CCE Master Gardener who used to live in Greene County, but who has recently moved to South Carolina. Joanne, welcome to the program. We're so happy to have you in the area again and that you are willing to take the time to share some of your expertise with our listeners.
Hi there. I'm happy to be here and get a chance to revisit the beautiful Hudson Valley.
Let's start by letting us know a bit about yourself. What prompted your interest in gardening, and how did you get interested in garden myths?
I guess my interest in gardening started as a kid when the lot we lived on was surrounded by trees. I'd dig a hole, plant a flower in any old place. Well, they were good places until my dad got tired of mowing around them. My interest continued, but only in a reading capacity. Life got in the way. Then I retired, took the CCE Master Gardener program, and I was on fire. One day, I found a box of Epsom salts under the sink. I had heard they were good for the garden, so I sprinkled them all over everything. Then I got schooled about what a myth that was and wondered what else was hearsay. I came across Linda Chalker Scott, who has a PhD in horticulture from Oregon State University, and I found her on a Facebook group called The Garden Professors. She's one of a group of academic colleagues who entertain and educate gardeners, not only about myths, but on anything to do with gardening. Dr. Chalker Scott conducts research in applied plant and soil sciences, publishing the results in scientific and university extension fact sheets. So she and her fellow garden professors know what they're talking about. I was hooked.
So let's dig into the specific topic of gardening myths. Gardening life is full of myths and hand-me-down tips. One definition of a myth is false belief. Another is an ancient story. We'd like to use our time with you today to dispel some of the most stubborn myths in folklore while guiding all of us to be more successful gardeners. Perhaps we can start by citing a common belief and you can let us know if it's a myth or whether there's any bit of truth to it. One that I hear quite a bit, and I must say at times, is that a perennial garden is less work than an annual planting because the plants come up every year. True? False?
I just want a low-maintenance garden. That's a very common desire of many homeowners. A well-designed perennial garden can provide many years of beauty and enjoyment. They are easier to maintain when they are easily accessible. They are less maintenance than most annual gardens and require less water and have few pests when the native plants are used. Organic mulch helps with weed control and may even add some nutrients and humus to the soil, improving its tilth and moisture-holding capacity. But soil testing is important before you begin buying or planting. The right plant, right place will help you have a more successful perennial garden. However, note that tending a perennial garden can be enjoyable and satisfying work, but it's not low maintenance.
That's true. Just because they come back every year doesn't mean they can change their own diapers, is kind of what it boils down to. Speaking of perennials, here's another true or false. Ants help peonies open their flowers. Is that true or false?
Well, the peony is covered with a protective covering that this myth says the ants must eat away before the flower can break open. The truth is the bud will open on its own, insects or not. The ants are there only for a shot of sugar. So the ants provide from the peony's nectar, but we don't know if the plant receives any benefit from the ants.
Another thing that you hear very often is the importance of deadheading perennials so they'll bloom again. Is there any truth in that one?
This one is one you can say it depends. Some plants don't require any deadheading. Annuals, in an attempt to make as many seeds as possible, continue to bloom when old blossoms are removed. Perennials can slack off on seed making since they usually come back the following season. That said, some plants will flower again if the old flowers are removed. For an example, Coreopsis, but others do not. That said again, taking off the spent blossoms improves the look of the garden, like daylilies, for instance.
And daylilies, they've been modifying those so much, the deadheading actually will turn out beneficial with things like the reblooming Stella Doro. So that's the exception that kind of proves the rule, where you should always deadhead annuals and maybe deadhead perennials, unless it's this exception.
So it depends really is a good answer on this one.
Yeah, that's the best answer. What about daffodils then?
A daffodil stem needs photosynthesis, producing energy that is returned to the bulb. Many daffodil varieties are actually sterile and don't produce seed. So this is actually one chore that can be crossed off your to-do list. On the other hand, Tulips quickly decline, if not deadheaded immediately, preventing seed pods to develop. Similarly, the stems of iris blossoms also need to be removed, but keep the leaves so that the rhizomes can recharge for the next year.
So let's switch to another popular myth. The one I hear a lot is companion plants help plants grow better.
We're giving plants a human emotion when we call them companions. A better name for grouping plants is intercropping, not companion planting. A good example is the three sisters. That would be beans, corn, and squash. Gardeners should group plants according to the growing conditions they prefer, keeping in mind how those plants mature. Example, eggplants would be fine to place among shorter lettuce, as the lettuce would benefit from the shade created by the eggplant, while eggplant and broccoli would not be a good idea, as they grow to similar size and will compete for light and space. So, companion plant charts have entertainment, not scientific value.
So it's companions for architectural and nutritional ideas can work, like with the three sisters that you mentioned. The corn is there as a structural support for the beans climbing up, and the squash make a nice mulch underneath, but they don't each profit from the other ones being there, other than mechanically, that they've got a structure to work around. So
right.
They still are kind of companion plants, but they're not something where, oh my goodness, these work so much better together than they would by themselves.
Right. Okay. A common companion combination you hear a lot about is planting basil with your tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not necessarily any real truth to that. Tomatoes don't taste any better with basil or without.
But it's handy to pick up some basil leaves on your way in with your tomato that you just picked.
Very true.
So there's some companionship, but I don't think that's quite what they're talking about.
Probably not.
In the 70s, there was a whole series of books about companion planting. One was Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic. And those were supposedly scientifically proven, and there is not really anything in the literature, because we searched for that, didn't we, Joanne?
Yes, we did.
Okay, let's talk about marigolds. Marigolds in your garden keep the bugs out. True or false?
False. Well, maybe. Tests show no benefit from simple interplanting marigolds with other crops. They do tend to attract beneficial insects, which in turn thrive on the pests. While there might be some suppression of particular nematodes when cover crops of specific marigolds were turned into the soil, no wide-scale deterring of general insects has been seen. But it still looks pretty to combine flowers in a vegetable garden.
And I had to look up nematodes. They're a little wire worm that lives in the flatworm, actually, that lives in the soil and can cause root knot in a lot of the early veggie crops. So actually, try it. Like Joanne says, it can be pretty and it might help.
True. But I can also tell you my marigolds did not deter any hornworms on my tomatoes this year.
What about planting tomatoes with eggshells in the hole to prevent black scab in the bottom of the fruit?
Okay, the black spots on the bottom of the fruit is what's known as blossom end rot. Basically, it's a lack of calcium moving into the plant with ample water supply. For years, it's been thought that there is a connection between this and calcium, so eggshells, Epsom salt, even Tums have been advised to be added to the tomato patch. These are all a waste of time. Stress is at the heart of blossom end rot, typically caused by uneven watering. Other stresses include excess water, heat or cold, dry soil, or too much fertilizer. Unless you test your soil and it shows a calcium deficiency, eggshells are not necessary. Rather, mulching around tomato plants will help even out the level of moisture.
And I think the amount of time that it would take a tomato plant to access calcium from an eggshell is probably well beyond the lifespan of a tomato plant.
Good point.
Okay. Speaking of tomatoes, you got to remove the suckers, right?
A sucker is any new vertical plant growth that arises from the base of a trunk. Suckers don't rob the plants of any vigor, but they do use up nutrients that the host plant could be using. This practice of pruning off suckers, however, does produce fruit that is slightly earlier and larger. Also, it keeps the plants off the ground, which in turn reduces common fungal diseases like early blight, Septoria leaf spot, or anthracnose by increasing the airflow.
I've got a story.
Okay.
My husband had a tomato plant that was being very reluctant to produce. And it was a big, healthy tomato plant, and it had lots of fruit on it. So I came home from work one lovely autumn day and found out that he had not only removed the suckers, he had removed all the leaves except two for each tomato. I took a picture, and he has heard about the string tomato plant from that day forward.
Thank you for listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson and Columbia County and Acre in Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. You can also email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Today's topic is garden myths, and we're joined by Joanne Schleich, Master Gardener Volunteer. Let's dig right back in, shall we? Another very common one is myth that you hear about is woolly caterpillars predict the type of winter we'll have. Any truth?
Probably not. Woolly bear caterpillars range in color from all black to all white, but I've never seen that one. Some with bands, but all with bristly hairs, which serve as protection against predators, especially birds. Folklore has held that the wider the middle brown band, the milder and shorter the coming winter will be. If the middle brown band is narrow and the caterpillar is more black than brown, the winter will be severe. In actuality, the band length has more to do with the caterpillar's age than with weather prediction. As the caterpillar grows, it does through several different stages, molting between each one. Each time it molts, the reddish band becomes larger and the black bands at either ends become smaller. The older it is, the browner it will be.
Oh, okay. I'm working on figuring out if it's a teenage caterpillar or that's going to be interesting to now when I encounter them. I'm going to try to figure out their age. Okay, I got a good one. Large crop of acorns means it's going to be a long, cold winter, right?
No. Oak trees are not clairvoyant. They also don't care about the squirrels, birds, deer, bears, and mice, in addition to other wildlife that eat their nuts, although they do benefit from the fact that some of these critters disperse and bury the acorns. Plants have one mission on this planet. They are all about pushing their own genetics into the future. White oaks produce acorns in 1 year, but the nuts on black and red oaks take a full 2 years to mature. An oak tree has a juvenile period of about 20 years, during which time it doesn't produce any acorns. Many oaks don't make a large crop of nuts until they're around 50 years old. An average 100-year-old oak tree, about 2,200 acorns per season, but only one acorn in 10,000 will become a tree.
So a heavy crop of acorns can be random, although certain types have a multi-year cycle?
That's about it.
Okay.
Basically also says it's tough to be a nut.
I'll attest to that.
The light green moss on the limbs of trees causes the tree to decline. True?
Lichen is a partnership between a fungus and an algae. It's completely harmless to the tree. Rhizines, which are similar to roots, attach but do not go deep enough to harm the tree. Think of them as an air plant, which gets its nutrients from rainfall, dust, and small amounts of decomposing debris. Not from the plant from which they are using for support. While many people think lichen causes the tree to decline, it's most likely the lichen was there long before the tree became ill. Lichens tend to only grow in areas that have good air quality, so that's good news.
So it's also an indication that if you've got lichens and things growing on your stone walls, that your stone wall is not going to fall apart, from the lichens anyway.
I'd never heard that before.
Well, think about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Got another one. When you're potting plants, you always put a layer of rocks or clay shards in the bottom because it's the drainage, right?
No. Putting anything at the bottom of the pot is bad for plants. The hole in the bottom of the pot is there for drainage. Studies have shown gravitational water will not move from a finely textured soil into a coarser soil until the finer soil is saturated. Since the goal is to keep soil from becoming waterlogged, it's ironic that adding rocks or clay shards will cause the very problem it's intended to prevent.
Okay, but you would use them to keep the soil from falling out the hole.
Me, personally, I use a coffee filter.
Okay. Sounds like that much more work. Sensible and less weight.
So I've got another one. Landscape fabric provides permanent weed control for ornamental landscapes. What do you think about that one?
I'm shaking my head. This one's personal. It's like the person always on a diet looking for the permanent fix-it solution. There's no such thing. Textiles degrade in the landscape in as little as 1 year if unprotected from the sun or the weather, any weather elements. Then the remnants are unattractive, and then when they're removed, the textiles can damage surrounding plants. If you put organic matter on top of fabric, it will be colonized by weeds. If you use inorganic mulch, such as pebbles, that increases heat and can stress the plants. That requires increased watering and keeping the fabric free of debris. Using several inches of organic mulch will help provide an environment for beneficial mycorrhizae that assist in nutrient uptakes, reducing the need for fertilizer, improve the soil, and also help with controlling weeds. It's a win-win-win.
Yeah, except you put the landscape fabric industry out of business. Okay, well, while we're talking about mulch, newspaper and cardboard sheet mulches are excellent ways to reduce weeds and maintain soil health, especially around your perennials.
They're not as effective as other organic mulches, like wood chips or bark, in preventing weed growth. They can be dislodged by winds and induce anaerobic conditions or become hydrophobic if allowed to dry out. And they are not aesthetically appealing when exposed. However, they can be effective for annual beds if they are properly maintained. Permanent ornamental landscapes are not appropriate locations for newspaper and cardboard sheet mulches. The use of the newspaper and or cardboard in row crops has been shown to have okay results in the past, but causes extra work due to the need to shred the cardboard or layer the newspaper. What has shown good results is using paper mulches in what's called a lasagna gardening.
For our listeners, perhaps you can define exactly what is lasagna gardening.
It's using alternator layers of cardboard, soil, compost, and wood chips, in no particular order. This has proven to improve compacted soil, ruts in lawns, and suppress weed growth when preparing a new garden bed.
Okay, that makes more sense than trying to stick them in between your daisies. What about the myth of the Clorox clipper, that a bleach solution is the best choice to disinfect? She's rolling her eyes.
Yeah. Anyone who has made an investment in good gardening tools probably maintains them on a regular basis. Probably not daily, unless you come in contact with diseases like Dutch elm, fire blight, sudden oak. You might also want to disinfect the plant wounds, but what to use? A lot of websites advise mixing chlorine bleach with water and dipping the tool after each use. The reality is, you need to remove the dirt, and debris first so your disinfectant can work. Bleach MSDS states that it may cause pitting and discoloration. Now, the MSDS is Material Safety Data Sheet. It's information on potential health effects from chemicals and gives safe working procedures when you're using them. So, the pits will harbor microbes that are unaffected by a quick sterilization. We all know what bleach does to clothing. Do you want to deal with that in the field? It irritates your skin, possibly even your nose or your throat. Bleach is phototoxic to both people and plants and will damage the next cuts that you make. Never apply disinfectant to plants. This just adds insult to injury, making it harder for the plant to heal itself.
Okay, back up. What is phototoxicity?
It's the reaction caused when bleach comes in contact with your skin and then your skin gets exposed to the sun. It can cause irritation to both plants and people.
Oh, okay. So if you wipe down the plant wound, you're exposing it to that potential damage.
Right.
Gotcha.
So then what should we use to disinfect our tools?
Well, alcohol dips are moderately safe, but they're expensive. And copper compounds are not environmentally safe options. Old-fashioned household cleaners with a pine compound or mouthwashes that have a 21% alcohol solution, not the flavored ones, are your best bet. Just remember to wipe off the tool to avoid injuring the next plant. Also remember to disinfect any garden supports like tomato cages and flower pots, as they also can harbor diseases from one year to another.
Okay, you mentioned Epsom salts earlier as being marketed as safe and natural. Is this true? You said you were schooled on that.
No.
Okay.
Epsom salts have been credited with discouraging pests on roses, deterring slugs and voles, helping seeds germinate, even making bushes bushier, and too many more to even think about. The only science-based research with Epsom salts that has been proven to work were two studies addressing flower production on apples and orchids. The apple-based research was conducted on an intensely harvested crop that was known to be suffering from magnesium deficiency. And of course, the flowering increased once the deficiency was removed. The orchid research found no increase in flowering associated with Epsom salts. And another orchid researcher stated, there is no scientific evidence that suggests Epsom salts added to orchids or any other plant will encourage increased flowering. Every gardener wants the simpler approaches to gardening. Unfortunately, Epsom salts are not the answer. Once again, get your soil tested regularly. Your local CCE office will be able to help you with this.
Okay, for logical reasons, the Epsom salts are suggested as the cure-all because they're composed of magnesium and sulfur, both of which are important nutrients for plants. So we're back to the thing where you produce large-scale minerals or something and toss them in the soil and expect the plant to be able to mine them and sift through them and pick up the molecules they need, and it doesn't work too much.
They don't use that much magnesium and sulfur.
No, they
so
can't
they
possibly.
Don't need a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as disadvantages of using Epsom salts, are they a pollutant?
I would think so.
Okay. Which makes me think of mothballs.
Oh.
People love to recommend mothballs, particularly as a deterrent for insects and animal pests. But I know that they can become a pollutant too, and they're also toxic to the environment. And they also look like candy to ignorant little kids.
Little kids, yeah.
Yeah, so that's another thing to, if they tell you to use mothballs, don't.
Right. They're not labeled for use on food products anyway.
Okay. Let's digress, give you a break for a few minutes. We'll talk about some of the differences in the ways you garden in South Carolina versus New York. It's obviously warmer and a different plant hardiness zone. So what have you observed?
Well, we moved into a new subdivision, so I know about lasagna gardening and renewing compacted construction soil. I journaled our lot for the first year, looking at where and when the sun shone, shady areas, where the water puddled, wind direction, everything. Anything to figure out what to plant and where to plant it. Then I found out that our last spring frost date was about March 17th. I didn't know if I was scared or happy. I'd been told that the larger tomatoes, like beefsteaks, don't do well in the area due to the extreme heat. We tried for grape tomatoes and did okay. Knowing my construction soil wasn't ready for planting, we were anxious and excited. But we got a second harvest from the same tomato plant in late November. I'm told that's to be expected if people would only wait through the plant's ugly stage that happens in the heat of July and August. We did get quite familiar with tomato and tobacco hornworms, and Japanese beetles are so prolific, I could catch them with my hands.
Blech.
Yeah, and they don't taste good either. My container of soapy water was never empty. As far as diseases go, they have mostly the same ones. It's just that with the longer growing season, they tend to stick around longer. But I was disappointed when I found out that tulips are an annual in South Carolina. And the lilacs don't like the heat at all. Almost everyone has a gardenia or a crepe myrtle, both of which can be very showy focal points in a garden. Lastly, my favorite bird, the goldfinch, only comes around in the fall and winter months, so I don't get to see his bright yellow plumage anymore. On the flip side, we've had a bluebird house that has had three broods in one breeding season.
Holy cow.
I guess you have to take the good with the bad.
Joanne, it's been a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and expertise. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program, as well as production support from Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative Extension by checking out our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. You can contact us by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Master Gardeners are typically available on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays in the Hudson office, or on Tuesday and Thursday mornings in the ACRA office. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let us help your garden grow.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreen.org, visit us in Hudson or in ACRA, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below.